And another image of wilderness in the hymnal, this time 559. O thou in whose presence my soul takes delight. I invite you to stand if you're able. O thou in whose
Good morning, everyone. Hannah, hide your face. I'm going to embarrass you really quickly. So what's really beautiful about Hannah Clatterbuck sharing this morning about the wilderness is that she essentially is a child of the wilderness. Hannah is a person who needs to take her respite. She is wise enough in her 16 years to know when she's had enough. Her mom has said that there are nights when she just sleeps in a tree, and they trust that she'll find her way home. So thank you, Hannah, for being willing to take your mom's spot this morning with Children's Time. Good morning. Hi. 2 weeks ago, we were in a staff meeting, and we were talking about things that are coming up in the month ahead, and it was in that staff meeting that we realized that Leslie and Susan and Melinda would all be out of state this weekend. And Susan's eyes got like really big because she realized she needed to find someone to preach. We still don't know how that happened. But I think it was actually kind of supposed to happen this way. I'll tell you why. When I was a senior at Lancaster Mennonite High School, our spring musical, my final show, was Children of Eden. If none of you have ever heard of this show, congratulations, you're normal. It's a somewhat obscure musical written in 1991 by Stephen Schwartz, who, if that name sounds familiar, he's also the person who penned Pippin and Godspell, and the biggest hit probably would be Wicked. So it follows the stories of Adam and Eve, their children, and then Noah. We're lucky enough today to have not just me who was in this production, but I have to do this, but Matthew was in the pit, Maddie Bauman was in the pit, and Noah, a.k.a. Hans Smucker, sitting in the back. So what's up, Noah? If you've never listened to this soundtrack, and I assume that you haven't, I really, really recommend that you do. Just be prepared for like some super hardcore 90s synthesizer. Well, the song from this show that's been running around in my head all month has been Lost in the Wilderness. This song gets stuck in my head periodically, and it does that a lot. It springs out of nowhere, takes residence in the back of my mind, and is pretty relentless in how long it holds on. And so when we were in this staff meeting where we realized no one was going to preach, and Susan's eyes got really big, I just said, "Oh, yeah, okay, I got this." And Susan's like, "Oh, are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, I don't want to put anybody in church, like, on the spot. It's fine. I got this." Because I knew that this theme had been rolling around in my head for a reason, and this was going to be my opportunity to share with all of you my feelings, my thoughts, my experiences, and my musings on what it means to be lost in the wilderness. So being the church-going folk that you are, I'm sure you've heard plenty about the biblical concept of wilderness. I'm sure that many of you, especially our seminarians, could on the spot come up with at least a few theological metaphors related to wilderness themes. So I'm not up here to reinvent the wheel or try to say something that's never been said before. I'm not a poet like Susan. I'm not even going to try. So instead, I'll do what I think I'm kind of good at, which is sharing with you my personal experiences of the wilderness, and hopefully maybe encouraging some of you who have gone through it yourselves or who find yourself there now. In the Old Testament, the wilderness is a constant presence, reappearing time and again throughout the biblical narrative. Biblical literature is a literature of tradition. So the fact that wilderness is mentioned over 300 times in the text conveys a hefty cultural significance beyond just denoting a specific location or a geographical designation. In fact, one of my seminary professors called the ever-present wilderness in the Old Testament more of a character than a setting. I know this won't shock many of you, but the authors of these texts were not interested in being historically accurate. They were instead driven to put into writing the truth of their experience and their shared community theology. Therefore, these stories of wilderness experiences should be understood as theological and ideological constructions and not as historical records. The theology that emerges from these many wilderness episodes isn't one note. However, one common theme is persistent. Whether good or bad, the wilderness is a place of intense experience. 40 years of traveling in search of a promised land, a stark need for food and water, God's providence in the provision of manna and quails. It's a place of isolation and danger, experienced deeply by Hagar and Ishmael as they fled for their lives and encountered a God of deliverance. It's a place of renewal and tangible experiences with God. Entire theologies were built amongst the craggy steppes of the southern Levant, where the people were exposed, alone, pursued, lost in the wilderness. And yet somehow, time and time again, they found God in that place. What's interesting to me about this wilderness in the Old Testament is not that it was a place that people sought for, say, rest and respite. Instead, it seems to me to be a place that was only sought out of necessity, and often because you were fleeing from something. Always at the edges of the biblical stories, the wilderness is lurking, just around the fringes, just waiting for someone to flee in or out of it. Imagery that's used in the Old Testament to describe this wilderness is that of being desolate, unforgiving, which I suppose is why the writers in the Psalms use the narrative of the wilderness to describe the feeling of being separated from God. But if we set aside these ancient understandings of wilderness, the dry desert hills, the scrubby landscape, maybe we can invoke our own vision of what wilderness is for us. So, what does the word wilderness evoke in you? If you hear that word, what are the first things that come to mind? If I was in senior youth right now, I would ask you to say those things out loud. But I won't. So for me, when I think wilderness, I think the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. I think the craggy, wild coastline of Maine. I think of the sandy, white dunes in New Mexico. I think of still mountain lakes, like Crater Lake. I think of every photograph by Ansel Adams. Wilderness is glorified and romanticized in our American culture. We long for untouched landscapes and brutal beauty. Have you ever dreamt at any point in your life of hiking the Appalachian Trail or visiting the wilds of Alaska? Do you hunt for waterfalls or climb to awe-inspiring vistas? Experiencing the raw beauty of the natural world can be a deeply spiritual experience. I'll never forget seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time and literally being struck dumb. We sat on the lip of the crater for half an hour in total silence, just overwhelmed by the magnitude of it. I've often sought God in these wild places. While in college, I had a certain bluff on Grandfather Mountain where I would climb, sit, and then sing out over the Blue Ridge Mountains. While living out west, I found my center at Ecola State Park and Haystack Rock in Cannon Beach. There's something about these wild, ancient places that allow me to release everything that I'm carrying and just be. Do you have a place like that? When I think of these places, I'm immediately refreshed. I'm centered just thinking about Cannon Beach, seriously. How fortunate, though, that our wildernesses are quasi-safe. A lot of them are gated, staffed, often offering restrooms. But oh, the spiritual wilderness. That is another thing altogether. That place is barren, chafing, relentless. It's a place that I have been even more frequently than my natural oases. The wilderness of the spirit is a place of desolation, and it's lamented in the Psalms, Jeremiah, Lamentations, basically all over the text. It's a place that's so unforgiving that in the book of Mark we read that John straight up wore camel's hair and ate locusts. I think about places like the Australian Outback, where I'm pretty sure you can die like a million different ways. That's an unforgiving place. It's not a respite, it's not a place for refuge, it's hell. And if scripture is to be taken literally, and I don't recommend that it is, it makes sense to me that in this text it says that Jesus met Satan there. In my collegiate years, I found myself deep in this place. My faith had broken apart due to some extensive trauma. I felt emotionally and spiritually barren. I was angry at God, and boy, oh boy, did I long for the childlike wonder I once had. I longed to be on fire again. But it didn't come. It couldn't come. I was in a different place. There was no longer a place inside of me for that innocence, if you call it that, to reside. I was lost in the wilderness. Lost, slowly dying in the wilderness. It was in this season that, of all things, I began taking biblical Greek. On the first day, my professor wanted to demonstrate how learning Greek could completely change your understanding of Scripture, and the verse he used was Mark 1:12. It read as follows. Immediately, the Spirit drove Jesus into the wilderness. Kai eothus, to pneuma auton, ekbale eis ten erimon. The word of greatest significance in this line is ekbale, cast him, drove him, sent him. I'm just going to tell you right now, this word is not that kind. This word may not seem really remarkable, ekbale. It's used 81 different times in the New Testament. However, every time that ekbale is used, it's in reference to driving out demons. It is a word not only of strength, but a word of violence. It denotes a violent rending, a ripping, a tearing with irresistible force, kai eothus to numa oton ekbale aisten eremon. Jesus, the Son, whom in the preceding verses was legit descended on by a dove and called the Son of God, who John wouldn't even stoop to untie the thong of his sandals, was violently, irresistibly driven into the wilderness, torn, rended from his friends, his followers, and his God. He was in the place of desperation and solitude, just like me. This was a turning point. Forgive the coarseness, but if Jesus, the freaking Son of God, could be lost in the wilderness, then why couldn't I? There was hope for me. He was tempted by Satan. Insert whatever metaphor you want here. He was tempted, but he was tended to. He was tended to. He was helpless. Jesus. This basic shift in understanding allowed me to view the emptiness of my spiritual brokenness as a place of possibility rather than imminent death. I saw my wilderness not as a place of punishment, but a place to reassess, reconnect, be tended to. I couldn't help but think about the wild barrenness of Death Valley that once a year explodes with wildflowers. A few months later, I was home on Christmas break at a gathering with my high school friends. And myself and another girl peeled ourselves away for a private discussion and got into a conversation about my spiritual wilderness journey. She was concerned about me, and so I told her about this whole Ekbale thing. And I told her that it made me feel really peaceful. And I remember summing it all up by spontaneously saying, you know, you can't get found unless you're lost. It just came out. And I knew that it was the truth. It was deep, resonating soul truth. In my journey as a Christ follower, I found that there are a lot of surprises to this whole faith thing. Like, for example, didn't think I'd ever be in congregational ministry, and now I'm the only pastor here today. There are things about Jesus that I read, and I read again and again, and I kind of thought I knew him, but I didn't think about it very much or too deeply. For instance, you know, Jesus goes out into the wilderness all the time. Jesus is going out to pray. Jesus took a boat, and he went across, and he prayed. And those verses actually bothered me kind of a lot. I thought, hey, Jesus, there's literally a crowd there, and these people need you. So why are you wandering away out into the darkness? Why is it that praying is more important to you than being with the people that so obviously need you? But having been in my own place of finding peace in the wilderness, I don't want to say I get it now, but I understand more. The first time that Jesus was hurled into that desert, he was probably terrified. But he met God out there in a real and edifying way. So he returned to the desert whenever he felt overwhelmed. He got out of the noise and confusion of existence and just reconnected to remember who he was. We don't always get to choose our times in the wilderness. Sometimes we are irresistibly, violently hurled there with what feels like violent, unforgiving forces. Death of a loved one, loss of a job, brokenness in a relationship. Sometimes, however, we seek the wilderness in spite of to find our respite and recovery. No matter how we get there, I would implore you to remember that you're not alone and that one greater than you has been there before to make a path. The ancient Israelites passed on the theological truth that the wilderness was a privileged place for encounters with the divine. Jesus modeled it, and I believe in it. The last line of the song, Lost in the Wilderness, which I'm so tempted to sing, but I won't. Okay, it just says, like, and there in the wilderness finally we'll be found. So I shared the song with Susan. She actually said I should sing, like, during the whole sermon, but I'm not going to. But she sat with this song, and she sent me this. And since she's not here today, I'm going to share it on her behalf. It's from Anne Lamott. I do not at all understand the mystery of grace, only that it meets us where we are, but does not leave it where it found us.